any of the guys at the front. There you go.
Can you hear me now? Good. So, good evening again. My purpose here tonight is to look at three painted images by Leonardo da Vinci, as mentioned in Dan Brown's work of popular fiction, The Da Vinci Code. I've decided to look at three subjects as painted by Leonardo, partly because of the relatively limited amount of time we have, but partly also because there are only three Leonardo paintings which are of religious subject matter in the book. These are woven into Dan Brown's fantasy adventure tale in strange ways, I think. Certainly two of them are touched on only briefly. The other one forms quite an important part of some of the theories that Dan Brown has come up with. I hope that I can do justice to the title that the talk has been billed under, The Truth About the Art in Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. Well, what is truth? What is truth? You might well ask that. It was a question that Jesus was asked, wasn't it, by the Roman governor Pilate, prior to Pilate submitting to the pressure he was under to have Jesus crucified. What is truth? But of course, Jesus himself said, he is the way, the truth, and the life. So let's see what we can find out about the real truth of the matter as we look into some of the art mentioned in the Da Vinci Code. I'll just put the first slide up before I actually start talking about it, so that maybe you can gaze at it and ponder it while I ask the question. I wonder, do you consider yourself to be visually literate? Are you visually literate? What are your eyes like? Can you read what you see? I wonder what you would say to the question, how you'd respond. Can you see clearly? Jesus in the Bible, in Matthew's Gospel, says the eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? Going by that definition, I hope to show you through some of the comments that Dan Brown makes in discussing the various pieces of Leonardo's art in the Da Vinci Code, that his eyes are not as good as all that, and that his statement at the very beginning of the novel has to be seriously doubted. At the bottom of what is a facts page before the prologue, he states a number of things, but at the bottom he says, all descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals in this novel are accurate. I think that by looking closely at some of the paintings that Dan Brown gives his supposedly factual opinions of, we will see that his concept of truth is seriously flawed. So what we have on the screen is Leonardo da Vinci's painting called The Adoration of the Magi, painted in 1481. It's in the Uffizi Gallery in Florence now. I'm going to start by, not talking about the painting so much, but talking about saying what Dan Brown says about it, because he doesn't say very much. In pages 232-3 in the Da Vinci Code, he talks of how everyone loves a conspiracy. Then he speaks of the recent earth-shattering discovery that Da Vinci's Adoration of the Magi was hiding a dark secret beneath its layers of paint. He tells how Italian art diagnostician, even, Maurizio Seracini, had unveiled the unsettling truth of a Leonardo cover-up by revealing, beyond any doubt, that while the Adoration's grey sketched underdrawing was indeed Da Vinci's work, the painting itself was not. The truth was, says Brown, that some anonymous painter had filled in Da Vinci's sketch like a paint by numbers. It's American type language. He filled in Da Vinci's sketch like a paint by numbers, years after Da Vinci's death. Far more troubling, Brown says, however, was what lay beneath the imposter's paint. Photographs taken but with infrared reflectography and X-ray suggested that this rogue painter, while filling in Da Vinci's sketch study, had made suspicious departures from the underdrawing, as if to subvert Da Vinci's true intention. And that's just about the sum total of the factual discussion of Leonardo's Adoration of the Magi in Dan Brown's book. I say factual because he says everything is factual, but I don't see much factual about that. There are something on the internet about some of those claims, but what we can see, I think, from what he's written, he snatched something from the internet, and his only apparent interest in the painting has nothing whatsoever to do with its content. He makes absolutely no comment on the content. He uses this singular, forceful, provocative language. But there's nothing about the content of the painting. Should we be surprised? I don't think so. After all, Dan Brown is in the business of selling books and making money, both of which he is extremely good at. But has he any interest in the truth? I think if you go on the internet, and even there's a whole number of books, Gary Williams is one of the better ones, I think. All these writers of it who've written on the internet in response to the book can claim and have claimed convincingly that a lot of what Brown says is not the truth. However, let's look briefly at the painting. Painted in the 1480s, as I said, early 1480s. It was a commission for a church in Florence, or a church just outside Florence, that Leonardo was given. The commission was for the high altarpiece of a monastic church just outside Florence. It's called, San Jacopo Ascopeto. And what we have here is an underpainting. Leonardo never finished the work. He started it, and it's a subject which has huge traditions in Florence. If I go on to the next slide, we can see an earlier painting by an artist called Gentile da Fabriano, painted in the 1420s, which shows the adoration of the Magi. The biblical subject of where the three Magi, or Magi from the East, came to find the Christ child. In Matthew's Gospel, we read about this. Magi came from the East to Jerusalem in search of the one who had been born King of the Jews. They had seen his star in the East and had come to worship him. We know that they followed the star to Bethlehem, to the place where the child was. We are told that when they saw the star, they were overjoyed. And when they arrived at the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. This was a great tradition in Florentine art that had grown up because there was something called the Compagnia de' Magi in Florence, and they were formed, they celebrated the feast day of the Epiphany, i.e. the showing of Jesus to the Magi, and which fell on the same day as Jesus's baptism and the ecclesiastical calendar. This was 6th of January. So the fact that these two events coincided made this a very special event in Florentine society, because the baptism was the event in John the Baptist's life, and John the Baptist was the patron saint of the city. So there were special reasons for this subject matter being extraordinarily common in Florentine art, and many altarpieces were made which were really magnificent, and this is one of the first of the really magnificent ones made in 1423 for a church called Santa Trinita. And it also shows what happened on that day in Florence when they celebrated the Epiphany and the baptism. There were huge processions. So the contemporary artists utilized those ideas of the processions and added to the idea of the Magi coming to visit the newborn Christ child, and made magnificent paintings with lots and lots of figures. So Leonardo was working in a tradition. One was by Gentile da Fabriano. This is by an artist called Fra Filippo Lippi from the 1450s. And we'll notice again that the processional sort of atmosphere as the wise men who become associated with kings bow down before Jesus and the Virgin Mary and Joseph in this sort of very colourful setting. I want to show you these pictures because they set the tradition against which Leonardo painted his work. This is another painting by Sandro Botticelli from the 1470s in Florence. Same subject, bringing us closer into the event. But notice how the Christ child is very small. We have this mountainous or this rocky sort of setting, which raises up Jesus and the Holy Family, and the Magi come with their gifts to worship. Botticelli used this as a means of showing portraits of the Medici family, the ruling family in Florence. Leonardo was aware of all these subjects. He was aware also of this one by Domenico Ghirlandaio in Florence, slightly more organized with this kind of temple-type setting here, or as the kind of stable setting. We see background details of a massacre of children relating to the massacre that Herod initiated as he jealously sought to kill Jesus, who was, he felt, was this king who was going to threaten his reign. And he massacred all the innocent boys of around 2 years old, up to 2 years old around the time. This painting was made for a hospital church called the Ospedale degli Innocenti in Florence. And we see little innocent children here. The Ospedale degli Innocenti took in orphans from the streets and cared for them. And so there's a double meaning in this picture. It looks to the innocence of Florence. It recalls the innocents that were killed around the time of Jesus. And it celebrates the Magi, John the Baptist, who's included in this painting as an adult. Anomalous in terms of the timing, because obviously John the Baptist was only a child as well when Jesus was that age, a young boy. So lots of magnificent colours, lots of pageantry in these paintings. Leonardo picks up on that in his work. But he started this painting and never completed it. There were problems with, I think, with the way he worked on it. And as we, if you look into Leonardo's art at all, you'll see all his earlier work was one or two figures, maybe three at the most, small groups of figures. Here he was attempting a large-scale altarpiece with lots and lots of activity. And he seemingly wanted to make his subject far more complex than any that were that went before him. However, he was commissioned to the painting in 1481. He defaulted on it on the painting in 1482. And no, the monks of San Donato a Scopeto did not receive an altarpiece until some 15 years later, after the commission, when an altarpiece by Filippino Lippi was actually made for their church. So Leonardo defaulted on the painting. We do know that also there were additional aspects to the biblical narrative, and Leonardo wanted to incorporate these. He had these ideas that we see in the background of this picture of horsemen, battling horsemen, and these were seen to be thought to be the idea of excessive emotions, which figures in the foreground don't display. We also see very significant architecture in the background, which is also an important aspect of the painting, and we'll come to that shortly. However, there were three main themes in the painting. I want to show you that although Dan Brown claims that this was a sketch, and it obviously is a sketch, there's nothing wrong with him saying that, but the fact that he said it was painted over by some anonymous painter who kind of wanted to obliterate some of Leonardo's work seems to me to be complete nonsense. If we looked at some of the drawings that Leonardo did beforehand, it seems a very logical progression in the way he worked. He worked from lots of single figure drawings, he did lots of studies of hands, but ultimately I think he wants to show and emphasize the baby Jesus as the main character within the picture. The three Magi have come from the east. They've traveled many, many miles. We don't know how long it took them, but they came from the east to Jerusalem to find this Christ child. They've seen the star, and they traveled a long way, and they came to worship him. So here we see them worshiping him, kneeling and worshiping. One of them giving a gift, another one here kneeling, well, bowing down, almost kissing the ground almost, it seems. Another one here with his gift, kneeling before him. The main aspect of the picture is in this triangular grouping here in the foreground. What Leonardo seems also intent on showing is that anybody drawn into the ambient of the Christ child, of the baby Jesus, is amazed and mesmerized in a sense. Look at the way that this man is posed here in his face. This figure here. There's figures here discussing with each other. It's very murky in many ways, but this is one of the most sort of complex, in a sense, groupings of figures in the whole of 15th century Florentine art. Around the back here, there's a group of figures who seem to be leaning on the mound before which, or against which, the Madonna and the baby Jesus are set. And further figures here discussing, we're not sure whether this is Joseph or whether this is Joseph. We don't know many of the details. But what seems to be clear is that all those figures in the foreground have been really almost entranced by what's happened. They've seen Jesus and they've been mesmerized. They've been forced to think. Maybe we could say their lives have been changed. But those outside the ambience of Jesus here are seen to be, well, what happens in the background here? This architecture, coming back to the meaning of the architecture, we often see ruins in pictures of the Nativity, and these are meant to be the ruins of classical civilization, with round arches and particular types of columns that are associated with the ancient Romans and the ancient Greeks. And the fact is that this is a ruined building, and what the artist has wanted to put across is in the face of Jesus, the new era of Christianity comes into being, and the old values of pagan living, of excessive emotions, of warring behavior and so on, should fall away as people become aware of the peace offered by Jesus. So the main themes in the painting are the Magi and their reverence. These are often seen as kingly figures, but certainly highly intellectual figures who've come a long way, having heard somehow the spiritual sense that Jesus is the new king, and they want to see him, they want to come and worship him. So they are one of the major elements in the painting, but really the most worked up little detail there is this very dynamic little figure of Jesus. The baby Jesus, it's as if this baby has the mental capacity to receive the gift and look at his hand, it's raised in blessing to the king. Going back to the background area with these horses, this was there were horses and figures in some of the other pictures, but not treated with the same sort of sensitivity and ambitiousness as we see in Leonardo's painting. It's very difficult to make out here, but these wild, battling, jousting horsemen seem to be being verbally chastised by a group of female figures here, as if they are warning them against this sort of behaviour in the face of what is happening in the foreground scene. Because in the foreground scene, there's that beautifully arranged composition, and perhaps it needs pointing out that, you know, the way that the lines of this figure here are of the Virgin Mary I've shown are echoed in this kind of shaping here, as Leonardo is thinking compositionally about how things work together, perhaps in a musical sense. And we get these kind of curving shapes linking together, things going off in different directions, all sorts of different ages, all sorts of different types of figures. And Leonardo, one of his concepts was the idea of light in darkness. And it seems, although he was struggling with this picture, he'd done this, what is basically an outline drawing of Mary and the kings and the Magi, and he started to black in or darken the background. Thus, it seems, perhaps covering over some of what's below, but then he would work into that and draw out details from it. This sort of idea will become more apparent as we look into some of the subsequent paintings. This was the painting by Filippino Lippi that the monks of San Donato actually received after Leonardo defaulted, but this they didn't receive until 15 years later. And you can see it's a more complete picture, obviously, but it stays within the tradition of the earlier works, brightly coloured, celebratory in some ways. Leonardo seems to want to capture a more mysterious, a more focused idea of the baby Jesus and his coming into the world. And that very action, I think, of the baby relating to the kings, and the sort of sparseness of the foreground, in spite of all the busyness around, seems to suggest that Leonardo is really wanting to create something extraordinary. It may well have been beyond his scope, because, as I said, he'd only worked with themes which were quite simple beforehand, one or two figures. However, his defaulting on the painting was partly because he left Florence to go to work in Milan, where he was called really by the Duke of Milan, Ludovico Sforza, who he worked for. Milan was a rather different type of city, and perhaps there was more possibility, a larger city, and more possibility for the sort of work that Leonardo wanted to do. Florence was quite a restrictive art centre in many ways, although we do know it as the place where the Renaissance flowered. Anyway, this is Leonardo's first major work that he completed in Milan, and it's surrounded by controversy as well. It's known as the Virgin of the Rocks, or the Madonna of the Rocks. Brown plays on the words, Madonna of the Rocks, and comes up with one of his strange little sort of wordplay things, which sort of subverts the meaning. And here we have this incredibly strange painting in many ways, but very beautiful in others. It's very strange in many ways because there are two versions of it. This is the second version, which is actually in the National Gallery in London. The first one is thought to be from the 1480s, and the second one is thought to have been completed around about 1508. Let's see what Dan Brown has to say about these. He says about Da Vinci's original commission for the Madonna of the Rocks, as he says, had come from an organisation known as the Confraternity of the Immaculate Conception, which needed a painting for the centrepiece of an altar triptych in their church of San Francesco in Milan. He says the nuns gave Leonardo specific dimensions and the desired theme for the painting, the Virgin Mary, Baby John, the Baptist, Uriel, the angel, and baby Jesus sheltering in a cave. Although Da Vinci did as they requested, when he delivered the work, Brown says, the group reacted with horror. He had filled the painting with explosive and disturbing details. The painting showed a blue-robed Virgin Mary sitting with her arms around an infant child, presumably John the Baptist. Oddly, though, rather than the usual Jesus blessing John scenario, it was the baby John who was blessing Jesus, and Jesus was submitting to his authority. More troubling still, Brown says, Mary was holding one hand high above the head of the infant John and making a decidedly threatening gesture, her fingers looking like eagle's talons, gripping an invisible head. Finally, the most obvious and frightening image, just below Mary's curling fingers, Uriel, the angel, was making a cutting gesture with his hand, as if slicing the neck of the invisible head gripped by Mary's claw-like hand. So lots of supposition. It sounds great if you're reading it, but when you actually see it in relation to the painting, to me it seems like a lot of nonsense. The book carries on. Langdon's students, that's the art historian in the book, were always amused to learn that Da Vinci eventually mollified the confraternity by painting them a second, watered-down version of the Madonna of the Rocks, in which everyone was arranged in a more orthodox manner. We've had a quick look at the two paintings. There's not much difference in the grouping, but let's just pick up on some of the things that Brown claims. We know for a fact that in 1843, the Milanese confraternity, he mentions this confraternity, but a confraternity is a brotherhood. And Dan Brown says they're nuns. Well, they weren't nuns. It was a brotherhood. This confraternity of the Immaculate Conception commissioned Leonardo to paint decorations for their large altarpiece in the church of San Francesco Grande in Milan. And the whole altarpiece would have resembled a miniature temple compressed against a wall and decorated with polychrome sculpture and paintings. It was Leonardo and other artists who were involved in working on this. There's a whole range of things about the commission, problems with it, And it sounds like at one stage, Leonardo and his fellow artists were in dispute with the confraternity about the price that they were being offered, which was 25 ducats for, quote, Our Lady done in oils, a picture of the Virgin Mary, in essence, not with all the details that Brown claims. He's only given it those details of all the four figures in the picture because he's seen them in the picture and has some knowledge or some awareness of what's in the picture. I don't think he's looked at it very carefully, because if we look at it, he claims that, well, first of all, what does he claim? He had filled the painting with explosive and disturbing details. I don't think, looking at it oneself, I don't think one sees these. Oddly enough, he says, rather than Jesus blessing John scenario, he seems to think that this is John and this is Jesus, which doesn't seem to make any sense at all. He also says the blue-robed Virgin Mary is sitting, when in fact she's kneeling, with her arms around an infant child. Well, she has one arm on the shoulder of this infant child, who I would take as John the Baptist. And Brown says, well, presumably John the Baptist. She's sitting with her arms around an infant child. Oddly enough, though, rather than the usual blessing, Jesus blessing John scenario, we have Jesus submitting to John's authority, according to Brown. Now, the way things are, if we think about it from the Bible perspective, John the Baptist was born a few months before Jesus. So he's likely to be a slightly bigger child. So that would suggest that this is John the Baptist. This is Mary, obviously, Mary, and she has her arm around him. And if we looked very closely, it's not ever so clear in the light here, her cloak, it's as if she's bringing him into the ambient, into the area of her cloak, a caring sort of gesture, as John comes and kneels before Jesus. This is Jesus, who is again, like we saw in the Adoration of the Magi painting, is blessing John. And this is the angel who Dan Brown calls Uriel, sort of an apocryphal angel figure, who is pointing towards John the Baptist. Now, John the Baptist, in many paintings, is shown pointing towards Jesus. He comes before Jesus in the Bible. He points the way to one greater than him. And so it's interesting that in this case, Uriel is pointing to John the Baptist. An interesting compositional arrangement here with Jesus' hand, Uriel's hand, and Mary's hand. Now, this thing about Mary's hand being as if holding a head, an invisible head, and what sort of idea is that? About holding an invisible head with frighteningly threatening gestures, her fingers looking like eagle's talons. What Leonardo is doing is showing his ability to paint a hand in foreshortening. He may have enlarged it a little bit, because the foreshortening of the hand perhaps makes it look a little bit smaller. But to me, that gesture is a gesture of protection. It always has been, as far as I've been concerned, when I've looked at the picture, over Jesus. And maybe something to do with Uriel's hand as well, or the angel's hand. I would be hesitant to give a name to the angel, but what is very interesting is, okay, we've got a young baby here. Whereas in the last one, and in this one, it seems as if he's been given this symbolic ability within the painting to bless, even at this young age. And but the angel is supporting the baby. It's a very natural gesture. An angel comes to support Jesus, to uphold him when he is praying in the Garden of Gethsemane before he's going on the night before he's arrested and the day before he dies. An angel comes and supports Jesus. I think the idea here is that this whole scenario took place at the time when Joseph had been warned by an angel in a dream to take Mary and the baby Jesus to Egypt, to avoid Herod's soldiers. And we touched on those briefly in that other painting. As he was jealously guarding his own kingdom, Herod sought to kill any threat. He didn't know who it was, this baby was, so he sought to kill all the young boys born around the time he heard about the birth of Jesus. And we know, the Bible tells us, that Jesus was taken to Egypt. And we know also John the Baptist survived, because he was later a grown man who predicted, or paved the way, as it were, for Jesus by telling people that they had to be baptized for the forgiveness of their sins. So this is an apocryphal meeting of the Holy Family, with at least Mary and Jesus, with John the Baptist in the wilderness. There were all sorts of stories about John the Baptist leaving home as a young boy and going to live a kind of hermit-like life in the wilderness. These were particularly prevalent in the 14th century and became part of Italian tradition. So I think it would seem very logical that these ideas are coming together in Leonardo's mind and his creative mind as he creates this Mary and Jesus picture with an angel and John the Baptist. But when we think about it, if we really think about it and think about Mary is kneeling before Jesus as well, although she's his protector, his mother protector, as it were, she is taking John into her protection at this point, and they are like a family around Jesus. She protects him. And Leonardo's concern, what he couldn't quite bring together, although he was attempting to, in the Adoration of the Magi, with all that different sort of activity, what he's trying to do here is to make a really harmonized foreground image in which every figure relates to the other one, not just in sort of gesture, but also in gaze and in emotional kind of sensitivity. I think that's what he was trying to do in the previous painting that we looked at. But with such an enormous number of figures, it would have taken him years and years to complete. And he wasn't really that skilled in doing that at that point. And in fact, he never, ever did paint a picture as complicated as the Adoration of the Magi in his subsequent works. So we've got this rocky environment. So that stands for the kind of wilderness maybe John went into. It's like, it also may have many other meanings, but it's almost like a shelter, a cavernous shelter. And like Mary's hand comes over Jesus, it seems to me that the rock, the cave-like structure, is coming towards and protecting the family. There isn't time, but many of the plants in the picture are thought to be symbolic as well. And the fact that, obviously, John later on would baptize Jesus is perhaps hinted at by a pool down here. But interesting points to note in this picture is that this one, the angel looks out towards us. This is very much a kind of 1450s to 1480s kind of tradition. The artists were encouraged to have one figure in their paintings who would make eye contact with the audience, in a sense to draw them into the picture. And this, I think, is what the angel is doing here, and pointing towards John the Baptist, who's pointed to John the Baptist, who's kneeling before Jesus and therefore receiving Jesus' blessing. Brown seems to have got all his identifications mixed up and doesn't really seem to have taken on board any of the further elements that would have been influencing the creative thoughts of the painter at the time. However, there is this problem with, well, we've got a close-up here which shows some of these details more clearly. This kind of across the image gestures. The space is important. The eye contact by Jesus and the hand gesture and the movements. There's this tight interrelationship within the kind of freedom of the space in which they're posed. And they all link together, a bit like I was trying to suggest in the previous picture, in this triangular grouping, which in fact is a three-dimensional grouping. If we were to draw a circle in perspective around the group, and imagining where their feet were, you get this kind of circle in perspective, and then if we joined all the outlines, you get this kind of a cone-like shape, which Leonardo was very much interested in, this kind of geometricization of groupings without keeping it too tight. Wanted it to be very, very natural. He was interested, obviously, also in landscape, in rock structures, in lighting. And this painting does bring together those ideas I mentioned of light in dark, as most of the picture is very dark and some of the prominent details are drawn out. And this nicely highlighted element of the inside of Mary's robe, a sash, or the lining, forms a link across here with the hand and the two heads. Those sort of linear and compositional elements were very much a concern of Leonardo's. The subsequent painting, which probably arose because the valuation that was put on the first painting of 25 ducats didn't satisfy Leonardo and the other artists involved in the commission, because they claimed they had been offered 100 ducats for the painting elsewhere. And it's thought that maybe a wealthy patron had seen the picture and thought it was so magnificent they were prepared to pay that huge amount of money. Whatever happened, another painting was made, and it's presumed to be this one. And you'll notice it's very different in style from the previous one in terms of the way the figures are painted. I'll do a comparison with the other one in a minute. But what we need to think of, what I want to put across, is that Leonardo's thinking is incredibly complicated, both in a contemporary historical sense, in a social sense. He's bringing into play biblical ideas, he's bringing into play apocryphal ideas in relation to biblical subjects. He's bringing into play all his own interests in sort of a scientific approach towards studying light and to studying structures of rocks and plants and anatomy and all sorts of even details about the way curls of hair fall down and spiral down. He's interested in all these sorts of things, as well as, in contrast to many of the other painters that we looked at, he's interested in creating a kind of darkened atmosphere which unifies the picture, which is very different to all those bright colours that we saw virtually all the other artists. He was moving ahead in different directions. Dan Brown doesn't touch on any of this. His analysis of this painting is no better than the first one that we looked at, I think, even though he didn't refer to anything in the first one. And although he does refer to stuff in this one, in these paintings of the Madonna of the Rocks, he gets most of it wrong. He doesn't really seem to have much of an understanding about what's going on. So the second painting is thought to have been made around about 1504, when Leonardo was actually sort of a lawyer was in touch with him, and a notary had sort of looked into the situation, and Leonardo was compelled to complete the commission within a couple of years. He actually finished it, and it was in place in 1508. So this is presumed to be the second version, which is in the National Gallery in London. Jesus, in both of these pictures, is the main active figure, if you think about it. This is an extraordinary painting. I haven't seen it for some time. I haven't been to the National Gallery for a while, but it's extraordinary because it has this cross and the halos on the figures, which the earlier painting doesn't have. But it's also interesting in that the figures are much more sculptural, they're much more three-dimensional, they stand out much more clearly. And here we can see very definitely that the Virgin Mary is kneeling and not sitting with her arms around. She has one arm around one of the children. And again, this has been added later, the cross and the halos. If you go and see that picture in the National Gallery, the surface around those is quite in relief compared to all the rest of the pictures. Some of this one is even unfinished up here and up here. So although it may have been the one that was finally accepted, it remained unfinished. But what has changed is the angel, hasn't it? The angel's face becomes much more passive. It doesn't look towards us. So Leonardo has revised his conception of the grouping. And now we can see a bit more clearly that the angel's left hand, as in the previous case, supports the baby Jesus, this young child. Maybe the children are not so attractive in some ways. I mean, this chubbiness around here is perhaps a little bit overdone as Leonardo. I don't know, maybe not. As Leonardo is very much involved in trying to be as accurate as he can. But he paints incredible details like transparent cloth in certain areas. And we know this is an angel. You can see the wings more clearly this time. An amazingly complicated image, which Dan Brown doesn't really do any justice to. He is keen to bring the details out, exaggerate details, and it seems to me that he's never actually really looked at the paintings. And there's a comparison of the two with the different styles very apparent. This is much more in a late, what we say, 14th century, 15th century style, and this is much more in a post 1500, 16th century style. Well, artists were much more concerned with making their figures look more sculptural. Leonardo was very much concerned here with the tones or the figures to be almost absorbed into the darker tones, so they seem to be standing out. He's still interested in tonal variations, but the figures are much more classical and much much harder in a way than in the first image. A change in style has taken place between the two. However, let's move on now to the perhaps the main painting in the book that Leonardo, that Dan Brown mentions. There's a whole sort of conversation goes on about between the young woman who's sort of involved in detective work and is learning from the art historian about all the intrigues that Dan Brown talks about in the paintings. But particularly in this one, The Last Supper, which was painted for the church in Milan called Santa Maria delle Grazie in between 1495 and 1498. Martin Kemp, one of the major authorities on Leonardo, has worked in St. Andrew's University and is at Oxford now. In the beginning of his analysis of Leonardo's Last Supper, says that Leonardo's primary purpose in the Last Supper was that of Bible storytelling. And the way Leonardo went about this, telling this story, was to paint what Kemp refers to as an historia, an Italian word for which was brought into art historical thinking by Leon Battista Alberti, an art theoretician, I should say, in the 15th century. And by an historia, he meant it was a controlled and significant exposition of a worthy subject. So this is Leonardo's version of the Last Supper, which is as complex, if not more in some ways, than the Adoration of the Magi, but it's structured much more tightly by the architectural background. And notice how everything in the picture points towards Jesus. All the figures that are looking that way are looking towards Jesus. The perspectives throughout, even the folds on the table, are leading towards Jesus. And notice how Jesus is isolated in the centre. This is the only painting by Leonardo that shows the mature, the grown-up Jesus, the adult Jesus, which I've only realised fairly recently, but most of the pictures where Leonardo paints Jesus are when Jesus was a baby alongside Mary. But here, unlike a lot of the pictures, Christ is in the act of, it's as if he's just told them that one of them would betray him. And what he's keen to do, as I think he was keen to do in the Adoration of the Magi, was to show the psychological, spiritual impact upon the rest of the protagonists within the picture and their reactions. These are the 12 that were with him, had been with him throughout all his ministry. He'd called them to be with him and they'd followed him. They were his disciples. And then he tells them at this Last Supper that one of them is going to betray him. What would their reactions have been? I think that's what Leonardo had asked himself. If we go back in time in 14th century Florence and see some of the other versions that were painted, as we briefly looked at with the Adoration of the Magi, we have this painting here as one of the most splendid versions of the subject by an artist called Andrea del Castagno. Earlier in the 14th century, and Castagno is concerned to show the explosive moment by using sort of classical elements in these marble panels in the background. And the marble panel in this one, you can see the whole picture is rather less dynamic than Leonardo's. The disciples are discussing or pondering within their own thoughts. Maybe one or two are talking to each other and have slight gestures of surprise. And John has fallen asleep. The young younger disciple has fallen asleep. That's a traditional element, as we'll see in some of the other paintings. And also traditional is Judas being placed on the other side of the table. We have to remember that all these sorts of images are theatrical. There would be people at any supper or any meal, you'd have people on both sides of the table. But they're meant to convey a message. They're artistic elements, which are artistic statements, which are meant to convey something, and we have to take that on board. But Judas was most often shown on the other side of the table, this dark, bearded, hook-nosed man, with all this sort of electric, atmospheric atmosphere implied by that stone in the background, to show you that this is part of a refectory fresco painting in a church in Florence, a church called Santa Polonia, and up above you have the crucifixion and the resurrection and so on. All the images of the Last Supper that I'm showing you are frescoes. And here again we see Judas on the other side of the table, we see John having fallen asleep, we see all the other disciples sitting very, in a sense, passively, might be gesturing slightly or looking slightly differently, pondering. There's lots of other detail in the picture, which takes our eye away from the essence. With Leonardo's Adoration, the Magi, he wanted everybody to look towards the active Jesus at the bottom there, and the king, the Magi, bowing humbly before Jesus. In the picture with Mary and Jesus and John the Baptist, all the interactions between the figures were clear, but Jesus was again the active figure. In these pictures, Jesus is in the centre, but his role as the sort of dominant figure is perhaps a bit dissipated by all the other detail and all the colouring and all the sort of lack of intensity perhaps that's going on. It's a gentle picture. When you come to Leonardo's picture, it is much more pointed in its purpose. Jesus is the central figure. He's just made the claim, one of you will betray me, and they're reacting. However, Dan Brown's theories about this painting are that the younger figure here, which everybody in art historical terms over the years has assumed would be John, the younger figure, the younger of the disciples, Dan Brown claims that this is Mary Magdalene, and that this picture is evidence that she was married to Jesus, and that because there's a V shape there in the way that they're positioned, they are, in one phrase he says, they're joined at the hip. In another section he says that this V shape suggests the kind of chalice. And the chalice that you don't find on the table, because they all have their own glasses, Jesus is assuming that there would have been one cup. This V shape is an ancient symbol for the chalice or the Holy Grail, and it's also a sign of the feminine. And all these little ideas Brown puts together, because this figure has long hair and maybe can be seen to be slightly effeminate looking, possibly. He is assuming that this is Mary Magdalene. He makes no attempt to say, if that was Mary Magdalene, where's the other disciple? Because there were 12 disciples according to the Bible. All the other painters paint 12 disciples. If that's Mary Magdalene, where is John? There are drawings for virtually all of these disciples. There's also the claim that there's a very obvious M shape in the picture, which Brown says may mean that it may mean Mary Magdalene, it may stand for Mary Magdalene, it may stand for matrimonio in Italian, but the claim is that this is Mary Magdalene, she is the Holy Grail. There is a whole range of hidden elements in Leonardo's art, and particularly in this painting, which it's something to do with the church wanting to cover up the fact that Mary Magdalene was Jesus' wife and his chosen leader for the church after he died. None of which is anywhere mentioned in any of the literature, any of the research done by art historians over the years, who have all unanimously taken it for granted that that is John. And what Leonardo is showing, in essence, is the psychological impact on a whole group of figures. And in one of the Gospels, we have a situation after John, Jesus has said to the disciples, one of you will betray me. One of you sitting at the table will betray me. We are told that Peter leans towards John, who was the closest to Jesus, and said, ask him which one it is, which one of us it is. And this is meant to be Peter leaning towards John and quite, you know, naturally leaning on his shoulder as he whispers in his ear, ask him which one it is. John therefore leans away from Jesus and towards Peter. It's a perfectly natural, explainable situation. On the other hand, Leonardo has changed the whole situation with regards to Judas, not sitting him on the other side of, on this side of the table. He's one of the disciples. Nobody there knew which one it was, or seemed to have known afterwards, although Jesus did, in one of the Gospels, does tell John. But Judas leans back and is still quite dark. The darkness seems to be on him, whereas all the other figures are quite light. It's a huge, like the Adoration of the Magi, which was unfinished. This is an almost devastated painting. It's a fresco on the wall in the refectory of the church in Milan, Santa Maria della Grazia, and it's badly damaged. Leonardo's fresco technique was experimental, and almost as soon as he'd finished it, the thing was beginning to fall apart. But the whole emphasis on this picture is on Jesus as the calm central figure of this picture. He is telling his disciples what's going to happen before it happens so that they will believe when it does happen. They will have that another example of that, of him telling, as he says, I tell you the truth. He says that so often in the Gospels. I am the way, the life, and the truth. And Jesus in the centre, having told his disciples, Leonardo is trying to put across the psychological impact on them, and they are responding in a variety of different ways. He wants his picture to be incredibly varied. He wants to think of how all the different ages, all the different types of character in the picture, in Jesus' group of disciples, might have reacted. So one throws his arms back in surprise and moves back a little bit. One sort of says, is it me, Lord? Others are kind of, notice how they're in groups of three. Groups of three. It's a very carefully worked out picture and deserves a lot more careful thought and discussion than Dan Brown gives it. His purposes are different, aren't they? He's not really interested in the truth. He's interested in creating a kind of scenario where you get these theories of controversial theories. He wants to attract people's attention. He wants people to doubt, in a sense. He knows that people in general are all up for a conspiracy theory, doesn't he? And that's what he's after. So he's turning around all these, or sort of inverting all these different sort of things in Leonardo's painting and making them up, really. He's a novelist, after all. He's using his imagination to tell stories. And that's what he's doing. He's putting across all these kind of things which are not in the paintings. And when you look at the paintings in depth, and really, it requires probably a lot more time than I've been able to give them tonight to really do them justice. Another thing that Brown claims is that there's an inversion in the clothing of Mary and John, and that makes it another sort of in Jesus and John, the one he calls Mary, though. He's saying that Jesus' cloak is red and Mary's is blue. Jesus' robe is blue and Mary's cloak is, it's like the blue, they complement each other. There's a yin and the yang. The outer garment on Jesus is blue. The inner one on Mary is blue. The inner garment is red. He says they're both the same, but they don't look the same here, do they? Leonardo is interested in and intent on creating compositional harmony in all sorts of ways. So within that harmony, there's an incredible amount of variety. So you get these figures pulling apart. And both sets of figures, although these ones are closer to Jesus, there's a gap between him. He is the calm centre of the picture, is the fulcrum of the picture, is the central focus, and everybody else revolves around him. So I guess we ought to be finishing. I want to be finishing now. I'm not sure that I've covered the things as well as I would have liked to, but there are three images by Leonardo, showing you hopefully that Leonardo's intentions and what he's actually created are very, very different from what Dan Brown suggests are present in the pictures. some of them, it seems to me that he hasn't really looked at the pictures at all. And I come back to perhaps some of the thoughts that we had at the beginning. But I just want to say that are we like, some words by the Apostle Paul from the second letter to Timothy in the Bible. For a time will come when men will not put up with sound doctrine. Instead, to suit their own desires, they will gather around them a great number of teachers to say what their itching ears want to hear. They will turn their ears away from the truth and turn aside to myths. So I asked at the beginning, are you visually literate? Is your seeing sufficiently discerning to allow you to see clearly? I've tried to look into some of these pictures and to allow us to see a little bit more clearly some of the things that are in them. So are you one of those who has ears to hear, but who have turned their ears away from the truth and turned aside to myths? Are you one of those who will not put up with sound doctrine? We might ask, is Dan Brown visually literate? I think from what I've shown you that I don't think he is. But is he one of those teachers, in inverted commas, who we gather round because he says what our itching ears want to hear? Many people just rejoice in things which say that the Bible isn't true. But if we look into the paintings that we've looked at, and we think about their meaning, and we think about why they were made, and we think about the central focus of each of them, which is Jesus, then I think we have to question what we are thinking and the sort of attitudes that Dan Brown is presenting. As I said about the Last Supper, Martin Kemp, a great authority on Leonardo's primary purpose for that painting was Bible storytelling. So, is it a time for decision? I don't know if you've seen some of the Economist ads that are around lately. There's one that struck me in relation to thinking about this talk. One of them says, is your indecision final? Are we going to come down on the side of false teachers like Dan Brown? Or are we going to come down on the side of the truth? I think it's time I finish, so I'll leave you with those thoughts. Thank you.
Refreshments will now be served. If you could remain seated, that'd be a great help to us. If everyone stands up, it's going to be a complete scrum. I mean, obviously, if you want to stretch your back, do stand up where you are. But if you could avoid milling around unless you need the loos at the back. And then if you can jot down any questions you've got, and then Stuart will pick them up. And then in the remaining 20 minutes, Stuart will answer those. Thank you.
Sorry?
Are you back on mute?
No. Yeah. Is it talk at East London Tabernacle? Longer than
okay,
that.
Okay, we're
going to... And the one last week is a bit longer? Was I talking out loud there?
Let's, if I can butt in. Now this, I wasn't...